Mikel Arteta says he didn't see any refereeing controversy against Bayern Munich, but we certainly did. We'll have all the reaction to all the controversial decisions involving Saka, Kane, Gabriel and much more. Plus, there's a look ahead to Arsenal versus Aston Villa this weekend. And of course, another game of Guess the Gooner. That's all coming up on this episode of The Arsenal Beats. Yes, hello listeners and welcome to this latest episode of The Arsenal Beat. I am Kai Karnak from Football.London on hosting duties today. And I want to let you guys behind the curtain a little bit. We, at The Arsenal Beat, we have a WhatsApp group where things can get a little heated from time to time as we discuss the big issues. And let's be honest, there were plenty of contentious issues from last night's game, whether it was the Bukayo Saka penalty call, Harry Kane, should he have been sent off? Should it have been a penalty against Gabriel? Were those the topics lighting up the Arsenal Beat group chat this morning? No, of course not. Instead, we were discussing what is the best Kylie Minogue song. And here to join me to continue that debate is Jordan Davis of The Sun. Jordan, I'll give you a few seconds first to present your case. What do you think the best Kylie Minogue song is?
I don't need a few seconds. It's Spinning Around. That's it. It's an absolute anthem. You can play it anywhere and people will start bopping. It's got one of the greatest music videos of all time. I won't spoil it. I'll let people go and see it themselves. But yeah, I don't have too much to say other than anything else is wrong.
It's a good start for a debate on the podcast saying you don't have too much to say. We've started as we mean to go on. Jordan Campbell is also here from The Athletic. Jordan Campbell, best Kylie Minogue song. Go for it.
That was a very strong case. I feel underprepared for my dispatch box visit here, but I'm going to go for Love at First Sight. I think Jordan's choice can be a little bit, you know, once you hear it too many times, it gets a little bit annoying. So I understand why he's going for it, actually.
Jordan's calling you basic. Are you going to accept that?
Yeah, but I just think Love at First Sight, summer song, just never get bored of it. It's timeless. And I can't say that the music video was the real motivation for that one. But I don't know if you believe me or not. But I'll let Sam join me on that. I'm assuming he's going to pick the same one.
Well, you've got in there as well. But on WrestleMania week, we have a right Royal Rumble for you, listeners, because we have not one, not two, but three guests. And the third guest today is the Telegraph's Sam Dean. Sam, I'm going to give you the deciding vote. You've already sort of given us a hint in the preamble here as to what you think the best Kylie Minogue song is, but what do you think it is?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's without doubt that it's the Better the Devil You Know. It's slightly earlier in the Kylie era. It's a bit more poppy, a bit less dancey, a bit less sort of repetitive and droney like the two songs these guys have chosen. So for me, that's the obvious shout, and I'm glad that we've had this discussion early to get it out of the way quick, you know?
Well, I think we've got our fighting spirits up. There's some real feisty coming out of this, the early starts of this podcast. But listeners, I'm going to be playing a little game throughout the podcast, just really to amuse myself as much as anything, but also be to test the three supposed Kylie Minogue fans on this podcast. We're playing a game where I'm going to be dropping a few subtle and some less subtle Kylie Minogue puns into the script of today's show. Yes, it is scripted before you ask that. But by the end, I want you to count how many we've got, and the listener will, I suppose, get the chance to crown Kylie Minogue's best song. I guess that's the prize on offer. We will decide who is the best. But
We don't have any little buzzers.
No, I want you to keep this to yourself as you go. I don't want you giving anything away to anyone. We'll see at the end who's got the best. And we'll, of course, have even more fun and games with Guess the Gooner later today. But this isn't going to be a solely Kylie Minogue-based podcast, unfortunately. We do have to talk about some of the game yesterday. And of course, there's loads of refereeing controversy to be getting onto, and we'll be getting onto them later. But first and foremost, let's start with a look back at a thrilling encounter at the Emirates. So it all started really well for Arsenal, didn't it? The atmosphere was incredible, and it was Bukayo Saka who gave them the dream start. Jordan Davis, I'm going to come to you first. How good were Arsenal at the beginning? I mean, I've seen some people even suggest in Copy Today that they were thinking maybe a reverse 5-1 could have been on the cards, given the level of dominance Arsenal showed at the start. I probably wouldn't go that far, but how good do you think they were in those early exchanges?
Yeah, no, I think they were brilliant. I think they pushed Bayern back straight away. I thought Arteta spoke pre-match about wanting to start quick and to take it to them, and they definitely did that. And Saka's goal was a perfect example of that, of just kind of Ben White pushing up and playing that pass inside, and it was all going really well. And you have to say that minutes later, after Saka's goal, had Ben White put them 2-0 up, I think Bayern may have maybe got into their shell a bit. I think the crowd would have been rocking. I just think you got the sense as the minutes went on that Bayern were finding spaces, and they'd almost spent the first 10-12 minutes figuring out what Arsenal were going to do. And I think Kane and Musiala did really well in dropping back and stopping that play through the middle. I do think it was a perfect start. And had Arsenal got the second, I think they could have gone on to win comfortably. But Bayern are far too smart to kind of fall into that trap. And I think they responded really well. And Arsenal, in the opposite, they just didn't respond well at all well to scoring the first goal. I think they were almost surprised themselves that they started really well and got that opening goal. And for the first time in a long time this season, defensively, they looked chaotic, frantic. They were very open. Some players pressing, some players were dropping off. And that almost cost them.
Yeah, I'm going to come to you, Sam, because in your piece from the game last night, you were talking about Gabriel and Saliba specifically, saying that they crumbled under the pressure of the occasion. I think it obviously all starts with David Raya coming rushing out, but then Gabriel misplaces the pass, and it's Saliba then who gives away the penalty for the second goal. But did Arsenal ever really recover from that first mistake where sort of Raya comes out and unsettles them? And it seems sort of from that point onwards that it fell apart quite quickly.
Yeah, I think while I agree with Jordan that the start was good, I also couldn't shake the feeling during those opening 15 minutes that there was a lot of nervous energy around. A lot of that obviously in the crowd because of the occasion and the opponent. But also, I think on the pitch too, there were a few sort of occasions where Arsenal players were doing things they wouldn't normally do. And I noticed after 3 minutes, Arteta was frantically urging his players to calm down and sort of gesturing them just to, you know, take a breath, chill. And did the same again after 9 minutes. And it felt all a bit breathless and a bit similar to last season, more so than this season, really, in terms of the way they're playing and the kind of frantic nature of it. And then, yeah, Kai, you mentioned the first goal. And I think it's basically three or four errors compounding at once. But I think the Gabriel one, for me, was the fundamental error. Because, yes, Raya's not helped him by coming out that far and sort of sowing seeds of doubt by doing that. But Gabriel still has the ball. He's in possession of the ball. And, you know, worst case scenario, you could still smash it upfield or put it in the stands and say, look, that was, you know, Raya, you've not helped me out there, but let's deal with it and move on. And obviously his pass to Kivior was not accurate enough. And I would say, to be fair, I think Kivior was on his heels for some reason. Like, he didn't seem to react to it in the way you'd expect. So that obviously didn't help. But you have to say that the execution from Bayern with the two passes from there and then the finish is just like exceptional. And Arteta made the point afterwards that that is what a team like Bayern can do to you. Even though they're not a great team in terms of their league form and the way they're playing, they still have great players. And like the pass from Sané into Goretzka, the pass from Goretzka into Gnabry, it was so clean, so efficient. And Arsenal were ruthlessly punished. And then, yeah, similar situation happened again just a few minutes later when obviously Kivior got turned by Sané. I think he tried to foul him, but basically couldn't. I think he had to give everything to bring him down there and take the yellow. Didn't do so. And then Saliba dives in. And I think actually at the point Saliba dives in, I think Arsenal kind of have it covered. I think Ben White's there and the chance is almost gone from Sané. So it was very unusual to see both Gabriel and Saliba making mistakes because we know how good they've been this season. They've been pretty much immaculate for the whole 2024, at least, if not going back well into the autumn. So it was very uncharacteristic. And I think that was an example of what these kind of games do to players and the fact that Arsenal haven't played at this stage before for a long time and that Saliba and Gabriel never have. So I think it had an impact. I think it was almost a mental thing as much as anything else. But it was unfortunate for Arsenal that those two centre-backs picked last night to make their first mistakes in months.
Yeah, it was a weird one because it was obviously going into the game, we were all aware of Arsenal's inexperience, but it seemed in that minute, in that moment after the goal, particularly the first goal, their heads sort of started spinning around and they just couldn't focus. They really struggled to get back into it. And I wonder, Jordan Campbell, if that sort of naivety was a real issue for them, because obviously this is, as Sam was referencing, it's not a vintage Bayern side, but it's still a side that has the history and the DNA of going really far in these tournaments. But Arsenal don't have that. And what can Mikel Arteta do to address that? Like, is there anything he can do? Because he can't change his squad. This is who he's got. So what can he do maybe going to the second leg to sort of soothe the nerves a little bit?
I mean, it probably just comes down to re-emphasising the fact that they don't need to change what they were, what's been working so well for them domestically. It almost felt like they were back to that sort of excitable, you know, playful, whatever you want to call it, team they were last spring, where everything was so over-exuberant. It was really sort of hectic, and you never quite had the belief that everything was going to be perfectly executed. You know, those basic errors, they've basically cut them out this season. You know, you can only think of really one or two. They started creeping back in, and I think when you start the match in that manner where there's a little bit of sloppiness and then Bayern start getting one or two, three counters on you, it starts to creep into your head that, well, we are playing a top team here who can kill us. You know, you look at Harry Kane's passing, you know, you only need to give him 5 yards and he can send someone 40 yards clean through. It was surprising for me that Arsenal were caught so often on the break, because my concern going into the game for Arsenal was Arteta has tended to, in these knockout games, you know, his record's not great, he's tended to almost be a little too risk averse in the first leg. You look at the Porto game, there was only two or three players in front of the ball a lot of the time. So that was my thing, was I wonder if he's not really going to go for it as much as the whole home crowd would want them to. But he almost overcompensated, I think, and really sort of tried to let them loose. Now, the pressing was working fine. It was forcing them to go long. But so many times, there was one where they had a corner. Ben White's the last man, and usually you can always trust him, to make the right decision, whether to go in or whether to drop off and recover. And, you know, you had a loose header, chased the second ball after it, and you just thought it looked like Gnabry and Sané and Kane, Musiala, were sort of, had got in their heads early that maybe this was a realisation that even outside the Premier League, if a team's not at the very top, this is a level above what we've been playing most weeks. So, yeah, I think Arsenal didn't manage the emotions yet very well. But as we say, if Ben White puts that in to make it 2-0, then we're probably not sitting here talking about that, because it's a long way back then.
Sam, do we maybe need to give Arsenal a little bit of credit on the night for getting back into it? You know, Arteta gets him in at half-time, sort of says, I believe in you, and things go from wrong to right in the second half, and it looks really positive. But things could have got a lot worse for Arsenal, you know, if Sané goes through and scores that one where Ben White does make an interception right at the end. That could have put the tie out of sight, and maybe Arsenal are a little bit fortunate that away goals aren't a thing anymore, because otherwise they probably would be out of this tie by now. But should we give them credit for not capitulating in the way they have done in years gone by? And you look back to those 5-1s, and when Arsenal got to 2-1, that's when things started to really go wrong for them. So maybe do we need to praise them a bit for getting back to 2-2 and effectively making the tie very winnable going into the second leg?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say that Arteta deserves special praise for his substitutions yesterday. I think in recent weeks, certainly in the Porto game, he got quite a lot of stick for not making changes and for being too reluctant to switch it up, but last night he made a couple of bold decisions and they paid off. The first of which obviously was Zinchenko on for Kivior at half time. And I think that the general consensus among Arsenal fans, having seen what Sané had done to Kivior, was probably a sense of fear and a kind of disbelief that they would put Zinchenko up against Sané in a sort of one-on-one battle. But if you look at the impact Zinchenko had and the amount of sort of the ball he received and how he was involved in the game, he made a huge difference. And I've got the numbers here. So both players played 45 minutes. In his 45 minutes, Kivior had 27 touches of the ball and played 16 passes. Zinchenko, in his 45 minutes, had 52 touches and played 35 passes. So they completely flipped how they play, and they returned to what they normally do, or certainly what they've done for most of the past 18 months, which is one fullback coming in, inverting, and sort of building up in a 2 and a 3. And they changed that from half time. And I think that made a difference. Bayern looked less dangerous to me after the break until that kind of late flurry. But I think Arsenal had more control of the game from the moment, for the moment Zinchenko came on. And the second sub, I think, is worth a note, is Gabriel Jesus on for Jorginho, sorry, and Havertz pushing back into midfield. I think, obviously, there's kind of this feeling or argument going around at the moment that Arsenal have moved on from Jesus and Zinchenko. But this was a night that proved their worth, I think, still, and how their experience and their quality still matters. And I think Jesus changed the game. I think the way he came on, the way he attracted players, the way he created chances. I mean, the assists for Trossard are just exceptional. And he's a different sort of player, obviously, to Havertz. He's more on the ball trickery than off the ball movement. And it posed different questions of Bayern and made a huge difference. And so, yeah, for a manager who's been accused before of not using his substitutions very well, I think Arteta made two very good ones there. And obviously the third one being Trossard, who scored the goal. So certainly a good night for him in terms of his decisions.
I think I have to agree, but I think it's interesting. So the one thing that Arteta's always spoken about in terms of learnings from last season has been the need to have 25 fit players going into this stage of the season and what that gives you in terms of an ability to change the momentum of games and to bring them back from the brink. And Davis, do you think maybe that's we saw that last night in the sense that this run-in is going to be huge for Arsenal and there's going to be so many of these kind of big games. There's going to be so many emotional occasions between now and the end of the season. And, you know, judging on last night, there are a few players in the squad who look like maybe they can't handle that as well. But is having the ability, like Sam illustrated so well there, to change that from the bench, how important do you think that is? Because it seems to be what the biggest teams have, and Arsenal haven't had it in years gone by. But now they do, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, Arteta's, you know, regularly spoken about seeing substitutions as killers, you know, finishers. He gets that terminology for Eddie Jones, for those, you know, Intersport group chats that they have and learning from different sports. And I think that's important, is the message even that he sent, you know, a week or so ago to the likes of Reece Nelson and Emile Smith Rowe, was that, you know, you might not be starting from now to the end of the season, but you're going to still have a role to play, maybe for 30 minutes, maybe for 20 minutes. And I think Trossard, you know, a lot of the time he does look more dangerous coming off the bench than he does starting. But I think, you know, what Sam was talking about was Zinchenko coming on and the amount of the ball he had. Arsenal really completely recalibrated the balance of their team for the second half. Everything was going down. We all know the right-hand side is a super strength with White now being let off the leash to go and join in, and Saka coming inside a bit more, Odegaard being allowed to come a bit deeper, but literally everything was going down the one side. And while it was producing two or three chances in the first half, they weren't breaking down Bayern regularly. And I think the second half, you've seen there was a lot more variation. Trossard was less one-dimensional than Martinelli was, I think. And Zinchenko obviously coming inside. Jesus being able to come right across and just basically play a free role. I thought he was unbelievable. You know, this is a guy who's talking about that he's not, he can't remember the last day he played without pain. You know, you think this guy is so sharp and his brain walks so quickly in those little pockets. I think he could be the key player in the Champions League. We've seen his performance early in the season at Sevilla. You know, maybe in the Premier League, Havertz is the guy from now until the end. But I think Jesus, even off the left, or if it's in the central areas, if he doesn't start, then, I mean, what a player to bring on. You can bring him on anywhere across the front, and I think that is the versatility that Arsenal do need, and they have got now. They've definitely got that.
Right, we've been able to put it off for long enough, but let's get to those controversial refereeing decisions, because I think that's what a lot of people have come here to hear, and it's what a lot of the people on this podcast have come here to talk about. I think there's going to be a lot of tension in this section between our contributors today on the podcast, but I think I want to start by trying to find a little bit of common ground if we can. I think something we can all agree on is that Harry Kane was very lucky not to be sent off on the night. Davis, I'll come to you on this first, but he sort of turns around, Gabriel is in his eyes, and he sort of leans an elbow into him, and it's naughty. The referee does see it on the pitch, and you wonder if maybe he hadn't, if VAR would have instructed him to then look at it and give a red. But surely that's something we can say that Bayern got lucky with.
Yeah, he has given him one on that one. He looks over his left shoulder and then puts it up his right arm. He knows where Gabriel's going to be. I was actually a bit surprised that Kane even tried to pull it off. In the era of, VAR and cameras and everyone can see you. It's a really ballsy move. And we know, and Harry Kane throughout the whole game was brilliant at being physical with Saliba and Gabriel and kind of backing in and winning fouls. And that's what he does brilliantly. But it was the one time I think he may have not lost his head, but he thought, I can give him one here and that, and I can get away with it. And he shouldn't have. I think it should have been a straight red. And I know players play actor not now, and they go down and they kind of pretend that they've been killed when they haven't. But Gabriel genuinely looked in a lot of pain. It was right on the jaw. And I'm surprised he didn't have any further treatment on it. I know he was down for a lengthy period of time. But yeah, Harry Kane is a very, very lucky boy.
I don't really agree.
Oh,
I think he's. I don't think it's a red, and I know that's going to piss off a lot of Arsenal fans. And this podcast is for Arsenal fans, so I apologise. But if you actually watch it back, and I've watched it back loads of times now, he looks over his left shoulder. Yeah, that's what makes him look guilty. He looks over his left shoulder, and at that point, Gabriel is behind him, big, ready to jump and challenge for the ball. If you watch Kane's arm movements, he's not swinging an elbow back high like you would cause connection with someone's face or throat or whatever. He's putting both arms back together to back himself into Gabriel, to try and pin Gabriel. And what's happened, and it's not Gabriel's foot at all, is that Gabriel's changed his position between Kane turning his head and has basically ducked underneath Kane to give him a nudge. So Gabriel's come lower, so Kane's arm therefore hits him higher. If Gabriel had stayed in the angle he was at the time the ball went up and Kane had to look over the shoulder, that arm would have caught him in the chest and it would have been perfectly fine. So while I understand it, because Kane's got a bit of a history of this stuff, and that's definitely true, I think he has got form for slightly dangerous challenges with aerial balls. But for this one, I think he actually gets a little bit unlucky that Gabriel ends up where he does at the exact point his arm comes out. And it's not an elbow thrust out. It's like an arms go back more than a real swing. And he's like backing into him with his back and his shoulders as much as he is with the elbow. So I think it's been a bit overblown. And I think a yellow is probably fine. And I can see why Kane has said today that he was surprised to even get a yellow.
I was going to say, I fall somewhere sort of in between, because I don't think it was a red card. But I also do think he knew what he was doing. I just don't think there's... I think he sees Gabriel, and I don't think it's any different to what you see Kai Havertz do a lot, or you see a lot of strikers do when they've got the balls in the air for 4 seconds. They're assessing the flight, they're assessing the contact, how much force they want to back into. I think that all comes into it, but I think he's not extended his arm out like a proper elbow. There's no excessive force, there's no real violence in it. I think he's done it so well that he's disguised it to look accidental, but I definitely think he does know that he's going to make contact. But I just don't think there's enough force there for it to be a red card. To me, it was a sneaky challenge. It was a little bit sly, and he knew he was leaving one on him. But I don't think that is a red card. I think it's got to be a bit more than that.
I would agree with you if both men were jumping in the air and Harry had to use his arms to get up and his arm was just there anyway. They were both planted. Again, looks over his left shoulder. And I disagree with Sam. His arm is raised. And as a player, you have a duty of care to know that if there's a player behind you and you put your arm up, there is a risk that if you catch him in the face, then it could and should be a red card. I don't see it as not much force.
There's not really any force in it, though.
No, but if you make contact with the head with an elbow and you've deliberately put your arm, there's no need for Harry to put his arm up. He's not jumping. He's
trying to ask his body.
It wasn't that high. He sort of tucked it in. That's what I'm saying. I think he definitely knows he's doing it right, but I don't think he's properly, you know, made vicious contact with him. I think he's just put it there and he knows that his momentum is going to collide with Gabriel. I don't think he's really swung it back with like a real intent to hit him. I think he's put it there knowing there's a likelihood that he's going to hit him. I don't think it's the action in itself isn't violent enough to warrant a straight red card for me. It's a definite yellow. It's one of those that sits maybe just above a yellow, but is not enough to be a red card for me.
Been frantically looking for Kylie Minogue puns to describe more anger and tension, but I was expecting it to be a more of a unanimous sort of decision between you guys. I'll say that we'll move on to another more controversial, I think, decision that will probably create even more debate between you guys. But Gabriel, again, at the centre of it, where David Raya, it's a really hard one to explain if you've not seen it, but I'll try. So if David Raya puts the ball on the ground to take a goal kick, you can hear the referee's whistle very clearly on the replay. So you assume the ball is in play. Raya takes it, or seems to take it. Gabriel doesn't seem happy with the way he's taken it, so bends down, picks it up, and decides to take it himself. Now, Harry Kane was quite upset with this, and he spoke to us in the mix zone after the game.
Could you talk us through the yellow card incident? It seemed quite contentious on both sides, the yellow card incident.
Yeah, strange. I'm not really sure. It was kind of a 50-50 we was going. We had them 50-50s all game, and yeah, he gave that one as a foul. Surprised it was the yellow card, but it is what it is. You know, decisions sometimes go your way, I think. They had a decision, and maybe at the end that was 50-50. We had a clear penalty, which would have been really strange when the keeper passed it to Gabriel and he picked the ball up in his box. But a stonewall penalty, I don't know why the ref didn't give it. It would have been, of course, strange. But the ref blew the whistle, he passed and picked it up. So it would have been childlike, but that's not our problem. The rules are the rules. So, but that's football, 50-50. They probably maybe should have had one, we should have had one. It was 2-2, we go to next week.
Davis, I'm going to come to you first on this again. Hand on heart, hand on your heart, do you think that was a penalty? Do you think it should have been one?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It sets a dangerous precedent, and I can see my two colleagues shaking their head. That ground, it's not as if they were playing at Galatasaray and you couldn't hear a thing and you couldn't hear a whistle. I just think Gabriel has heard the whistle and he's had a brain-dead moment and thought, I'm going to pick this ball up. Because that's what they normally do. Raya will give it to Gabriel, he'll put it down and then pass it to David Wright and then he'll play. And he's had a complete brain fart and picked it up. And you can see, if you watch it back, when Gabriel picks it up, David Raya looks at Gabriel as if to say, what on earth have you just done? And then they quickly just play on. But it sets a dangerous precedent for saying that you can pick the ball up in the box and say, oh, sorry, ref, I didn't hear your whistle. It has to be a penalty. If it happened in the press. No, and you know what? I've seen a few arguments being like, oh, it's for the good of the game and oh, it was a mistake and sportsmanship. Oh, no, that's absolute tosh. A player has picked up the ball with the game active. What are we meant to say? Ah, guys, nah.
Sam, should we be so lucky that the ref showed a bit of common sense in that instance? You know, he definitely could have given a penalty, and I see Jordan's argument. I'll be sort of devil's advocate here, and I'm trying to sort of referee this debate. But I think, yes, there's an argument that by the letter of the law, if you're enforcing the law, then definitely it could and maybe should have been a penalty. But is it a bit overzealous to give that, in the sense that it's not really in the spirit of the decision? And the referee sort of described it on the pitch. Thomas Tuchel said this afterwards as a kid's mistake. And I don't even know if you can call it that, really, in the sense that it's harsh on Gabriel if he's given it, because we see those kind of things happen all the time. Is it maybe a bit...
I've never seen that happen in a football match. Ever.
I feel like that happens all the time when a goalkeeper kicks the ball slightly further ahead to where an offside is, for example, and then the player picks it up, puts it down and plays on. Technically, you could argue the ball is in play, but I'm not the one debating this. I'll let Sam take over that side of the debate.
Yeah, I think common sense very much ruled here, and rightly so. I mean, Bayern have lost... Arsenal have gained no advantage from what happened. It was clearly not a malicious or deliberate attempt to break the rules. And frankly, I know it's not the point, and I understand the argument of the rules are the rules. And yes, okay, fine. But can you imagine if a referee had given a penalty for that in a Champions League quarterfinal? The reaction would have been absolutely extraordinary. Like, I can't think of any example of anything like that ever happening before in football. And the crowd would have gone insane. The players would have gone mental. I mean, I literally can't even imagine what Arteta would have done. Like, it would have been the most excessive punishment for a very minor cock-up, which had no bearing on the game or any impact on Bayern Munich in any way. And if it had happened, I think the meltdown would have been of just the highest proportion ever. And I'm glad that common sense ruled on that one. And Jordan, I hear what you're saying about setting a dangerous precedent, but I don't envisage players running around picking up the ball in their penalty area very frequently as a result of this.
No, I don't think that people are now going to watch this and think, oh, I can now get away with this. I'm going to do this for a set play. I think, had it been different, so had Gabriel taken the goal kick, booted it straight up the pitch and Kai Havertz scored, do you think that would have changed anything regarding that?
But the sequence of events is the exact same, whether Raya passed it to him or he passed, or Gabriel put it down and passed it to Raya.
It's like, still the argument. And then he's gone and scored. I know he hasn't scored in this case, and I do appreciate that there wasn't a clear advantage. But had that happened at the Allianz, in front of a full Allianz, and you say about the people would have gone crazy if they'd have given it. I think the crowd would have gone crazy had the ref not given it, and it was at the Allianz. And the ref hasn't helped his explanation of why he didn't give it. I think that's just stoked the fire a bit, and obviously Thomas Tuchel was fuming about that in his press conference. But yeah, I don't know. It would have been a very strange one and a very unique one. But I think the referee...
I could understand your argument, Jordan, right? I could understand your argument if, say, Raya's pass was slightly behind Gabriel or it was slightly in front of him and it looked like Gabriel had sort of got a fright and tried to sneakily, oh, no, I'm going to take it, right? I could understand it, but Raya had obviously thought, I'm just going to play it. Gabriel's not realised. He's literally reset the ball. There's half a second in between it. There's no Bayern Munich players even pressing or near the box. It's literally not changed one thing. So even if Arsenal had, say, he's passed it to Raya and he's punted it up and they've gone and scored, like, that has not actually affected the sequence of events after it. I just think it would be so against the spirit of the game. And I know you say, oh, this is all sort of over-romanticised stuff, but imagine deciding a game on that where you're giving a team a 70%, 75% chance of scoring a goal. I think we've almost become so obsessed with laws and how to interpret them, we've lost the... We forgot what the actual fundamental motivation was for penalties, is to gain an unfair advantage that has probably stopped you scoring the goal. That I mean, is just, it was inconsequential to me, absolutely inconsequential. And to give a team a 70% chance of scoring when you literally are deciding whether it's your goalkeeper or your centre-back who passes it 5 yards across the box. Like, to me, that would be so, so depressing to see football that referees did not have the autonomy to think for themselves and think, you know what, this game actually deserves me to think for myself and realise that there's more than just the laws of the game. You cannot referee any football match just purely by the letter of the law. That's just a given. Is there the reason why it's harder to get, if you commit a foul in the first 5 minutes, you're more likely to get away with it? Because referees need to manage the emotions of the game. That's why they try and not box themselves in. I think this is just another example. A referee who, bear in mind, this was quite inexperienced, for him to actually go, do you know what? There's a bigger picture here than just that's clearly he's made a mistake. I thought it was great refereeing.
I'm going to agree with you there, Jordan. I think it's interesting that, so you're right in the sense that we talk about rules and specifics of rules so much now. I should say I'm agreeing with Jordan Campbell here, not Jordan Davis, but the enforcement of the rules, so much of it is vibes. Like, if we followed every single rule to the nth degree, there would be a penalty at every single corner because there's shirt pulling, there's tugging, there's holding, there's all that kind of stuff. So if we start following rules to the letter and the way they're technically, you know, written, then yeah, there will be a lot more correct decisions, but I don't think the game will necessarily be better for it. And I think in this case, it's an example of the referee who I thought actually had a a pretty good game across the night, and it was his first Champions League game, and I thought he managed a lot of potentially tricky characters very well, and I thought he managed the occasion very well, the atmosphere very well. He was sort of zealous when he needed to be, but sort of a bit more standoffish when he needed to be as well. I thought, I just think this is an example of that where, yes, if you want to give a penalty, and I think there are referees, and Mike Dean probably would have ran over there and done a knee slide as he was giving the penalty, probably really enjoyed giving that kind of penalty. But there are other referees who I think are a bit more refereeing the situation rather than necessarily the laws. And yeah, that's my take on it. I just think it would have been very, very harsh. But I do see why Bayern are aggrieved. And I think I'm sure Arsenal and Arteta would have been aggrieved if it was the other way around. But I think in the grand scheme of things, if Thomas Tuchel had had that penalty given against him, I think he would have been as furious as he was coming into the press conference having had it not given for him, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I just think it was so blatant that it's so hard to just kind of say, oh no, we'll go past that one, we'll kind of brush past that and we'll play on. But because, and I get what you mean about like following it to the letter of the law, and I agree that there are fouls and shirt pulls at corners and that kind of we kind of let slide. Because this one was so in the open, so blatant, and it doesn't matter whether it was a genuine, honest mistake or not, because Raya's given Gabriel a ball and Gabriel's decided, no, I meant to be taking this one, and just picked it up. And as unfortunate as it is and as harsh as it is, I just don't think when it's that blatant that you can just say, let's play on, especially when the whistle was so clearly heard. And pretty much every Bayern player turned around and said, what's going on? Tuchel sprinted from one end of his technical area to the other to confront the fourth official. And I can fully, fully sympathise with him on that.
Okay, well, let's move on to, arguably an even more controversial decision with the last minute of the game. Bukayo Saka goes running through on goal. Again, I'm going to try and find some common ground here between all of us. And I think this is something we definitely all will agree on, is that Saka should probably score anyway, regardless of what then happens afterwards with the contact and whether it's a penalty or whether it's not a penalty. Saka probably has the chance to... Oh, Sam's shaking his head, so I've failed in my last attempt to find common ground. Go on. In fact, sorry, Sam, before I'll explain the situation just in case there's people who haven't seen it, and then I'll let you come in. But Saka goes through on goal. He tries to cut round Manuel Neuer, who's come sprinting out to try and sweep. There is contact between the two. Saka goes to ground. Referee doesn't give a penalty. VAR checks it and also doesn't give a penalty. Cue pandemonium as to whether it was or wasn't a penalty. Sandin, away you go.
Yeah, I've been through a bit of a journey on this one. When I saw it first live from the press box, I was 100% convinced it was a penalty. Then I watched a few replays with Jordan Davis in the press conference room, and I started having doubts about whether Saka had sort of thrown his leg out to initiate the contact. I've since watched it back like a lot, like almost an insane amount of times. And I think crucially watched it back at full speed as well. And I am now like back on completely on the side of the argument that it is definitely a penalty. And I think the key point I'd like to make among obviously a lot of people making a lot of points on this, that the pace that Saka is going at, he is running full sprint onto that Thomas Partey pass, and he gets to the ball and his first touch is at quite a tight angle. He's not just nudged it to one side. It's like pretty much 90 degrees from where he's running. So he's having to get that ball, he's having to change direction dramatically and at a top speed. And it's therefore natural that his body sort of swings around a bit. Like as if you were going on a bike and you had to corner really quickly, your momentum would take you to your right in this case. And I think he's going at such pace that it's natural that his body changes direction, his legs sort of swing out. And the fact is that Neuer's blocked his path. Neuer has obstructed his path and prevented him from staying on his feet and getting towards the ball. If that happened anywhere else on the pitch involving any other player at any other time of the game, I would be 100% convinced the referee would give a free kick. There obviously is these days this issue of players leaving legs in to create contact. But I don't think Saka even needs to do that. The contact's going to happen anyway because Neuer's missed the ball and Neuer's so close to him. And the more I watch it, the more I think that is an absolute stonewall penalty. And a bit like Jordan was saying with the laws of the game these days, it feels a little bit like we're tying ourselves in knots a bit, looking for who initiated the contact and who, you know, who did what, who did this, who did that. Like if I ran past Jordan now and he stuck his leg out towards the ball and I ran into his leg, people would argue I've initiated the contact because I've not dodged his leg. His leg's in my path. He's obstructing me and he's not got the ball. That's a foul to me. And I think that's what's happened yesterday. And I, as I say, the more I watch it and the more I watch it at real time pace, the more I think Arsenal have been really robbed on that one.
So I happen to agree with you, Sam, in the sense I think Neuer does overcommit. I think he's never getting to that ball and he comes out too far. And if he stops a little bit earlier, then maybe he doesn't. There isn't any contact between the pair. Having said that, though, there definitely is a strong argument that Saka does throw his right leg, out a bit more than he needs to. Maybe we're giving him a bit too much credit in the sense that in that split second, can he think that quickly, right, I'm going to try and initiate the contact, I can go down and get a penalty, get him sent off. Jordan Davis, you're nodding your head as if you think that is what's happened.
Yeah, like Sam, I've been on a journey, a long winding path on this one. So much so that when Sam came into the press conference, we tried to reenact it with each other to see where we could get our leg in that split second. It was very scientific. It was very analytical. But I think my overwhelming emotion is that had that been Harry Kane would have dived better. I think Saka has got excited and he's like, Neuer's put his leg out. This is my chance. And instead of doing the classic Harry Kane of just kind of slowly, naturally edging your body over the leg, he's decided, I'm going to lift my right leg up so I can guarantee I will make contact with Neuer. And I am with Sam on this in the sense that Neuer has blocked his path. He's put his leg out. But Saka, I think the ref has seen that Saka's over-dramatised the movement of the right leg. And at one point, and again, I've watched this in slow motion a lot, so maybe my kind of view is a bit staggered, and I've watched it live as well. But at one point, both his feet are almost in the air. He's almost off the floor because he's trying to jump to curve his body to make sure he's hit. So that's where I think he's gone wrong. Had Harry Kane been through for Arsenal, he would have won that penalty because that's what he's amazing at. And it sounds weird to say, but maybe Saka needs to go back to the drawing board when he's through on goal and just how to take contact without it looking too much like you're trying to win contact.
I'm going to go against the other three and say that I don't think it is a penalty. I'm not as righteous about this as I was the Gabriel one, but because I can understand the points that they've made, at the pace he was travelling at, the angle he's caught the ball back at. I've watched it at full speed because I think sometimes people, when they slow everything down, it takes the context out of the incident. But to me, Saka does not make the natural arc to follow the ball. I think he could get round Neuer because to me, Neuer baits him. Neuer is not a daft goalkeeper, and I think that's why I was surprised when he went down. I thought that looks like a penalty. And I thought that seems unlike Neuer to be so reckless. But I think Neuer comes out, dallies the leg, and then he doesn't actually follow through. If you see there's an angle that looks straight at Neuer, his leg doesn't actually go out the way. It goes out, but then he sort of plants it. And Saka does outstretch his right leg by a good yard or two to the right and ends up hitting him just below the knee. So I get what Sam's saying, you know, if somebody sticks out their leg and you run into it, I don't agree that people who say that they're initiating the contact, to me that's mad. But Saka has not tried to get out the road. To me, he's made sure he collided with that leg. I know you could argue that, well, Neuer should just never have done it, and I would agree with it. So it's a bit of a nuanced non-penalty, but I do think Neuer did pull out in the end. You know, maybe it was just too late to... He almost gave Saka the chance to do it. But to me, I think Saka bought the penalty. I'm not sure whether he thought when he put it around him there was more bodies inside and he didn't think he was going to get a clear shot off, and he, that's why he's bought the penalty. But to me, he still had the room there and he was still travelling at the pace that he could have just gone and slotted at home. So I don't know why he didn't, but I suppose at that pace, he's probably saw Neuer plant the leg out and tried to he's just instinctively made sure he hit it. But to me, Neuer actually pulled it back just in time for to get out his road. And I think Saka made sure he hit him.
Saka was obviously furious at full time, and went over to the referee and had to be pulled back by Albert Stoivenberg. But maybe sort of in a change of character, a change of roles, if you like, Mikel Arteta was much more calm in the press conference and sort of went for the classic Arsene Wenger, I didn't see it. I'm going to come to you, Jordan Davis, on this. Do you think that's the smart way to handle it? Do you think maybe he's learnt from earlier decisions that have gone against his team that have been contentious, and he's thinking, well, there's a second leg to come. I don't want to give Bayern any more motivation, because that's something I think that's got lost in a bit in all the discussion of the actual decision. But Arteta's reaction to it, in my opinion at least, is a lot more smart than maybe it would have been earlier in the season.
Yeah, it was Wenger 101. It was, I didn't see it, I'm not getting drawn into it. He was asked by several people in the press conference about it, and just straight batted it straight away, which I think is just good management, especially because he knows that there are decisions that could have gone to against his side as well. They've come from behind, it's 2-2, it's practically 0-0 going into the second leg. There's no need to stoke the fire. I think he's learnt from several occasions this season and the previous seasons, like at Anfield, squaring up to Klopp and the whole Newcastle game, and even his celebrations for the goals last night were more muted than usual. I mean, normally he's halfway down the touchline and has to be kind of dragged back, but I did feel like he was calmer. I feel like he knows that this is a two-leg game, but he knows there's so much more to play for, and he knows you've got Villa at the weekend. You want to keep focus on that rather than trying to just kind of reignite old fires. And so, yeah, I think it's a sign of maturity from Mikel, definitely.
You touched on Aston Villa there. Let's look a bit ahead to the game coming up at the Emirates on Sunday. So it's interesting. Obviously, the second leg in Munich is coming up, and Arteta will want to rotate. Sam, where do you think he can rotate the squad for this Aston Villa game? Because he's going to need to make changes. He can't field the same 11 in all three matches. And obviously, Jesus has spoken about him playing through pain. And I think in an ideal world, he'll probably want to start Jesus in Munich after that performance. So where does he look to make changes? Does he bring Zinchenko back in? Zinchenko's had injury issues. Does he play Thomas Partey? Aston Villa are no mugs. So it's a really tricky balancing act for Arteta, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I wouldn't be at all surprised if Tomiyasu came in for Ben White for this one. White's played a lot of minutes recently and covered a lot of ground at some speed yesterday, not least with that amazing challenge on Sané at 2-1 down. And obviously, I think there'll be a good argument to playing Tomiyasu in Munich, given what happened on the wings to Kivior, certainly. So I think it would make sense to give Tomiyasu some minutes, maybe at right back instead of Ben White. I can see Partey coming in for sure. I don't think Jorginho is in a place to play sort of from the start every week at the moment, or indeed probably never will be again, given his age, and that's fine. Rice and Odegaard, I'm sure, will play because they always do. Saka will play, I'm sure, because he always does. And I wonder if Trossard has earned a start given his last two appearances. And yeah, the interesting one really is Jesus, I think, as you say, because we know he's managing this knee issue. He said the other day he's been dealing with pain for quite some time now. And I think based on what he did yesterday, he's got to start in Munich. So can they give him an hour from the start on Sunday, or would they rather give him half an hour from the bench? And those kind of issues, I think, are going to be playing on the mind of the physio team for sure. But as we talked about earlier, that's the luxury of what Arteta's got now, which is a big squad full of fit players, and he can make these changes. So yeah, I'd expect two or three maybe.
Camel, there's no Douglas Luiz for Aston Villa in this game. He got suspended for too many yellow cards in the dying seconds of Aston Villa's last game. Do you think that's important? Because it's interesting. It's a shame to not really see him at the Emirates, because he's obviously a player that Arsenal like and have looked at. And it would have been fascinating to see him maybe have an audition, if you like. And we've been robbed of that narrative as journalists, but also have maybe Aston Villa been robbed of a good chance to win the game without him involved.
Yeah, I mean, he's a huge miss. I think if you look at his form under Emery compared to Gerrard, he looks like a completely different player. So I can completely understand why he would be a good fit for Arsenal, especially if Jorginho's contract situation isn't sorted, if Partey's contract or he moves on, you know, you're looking for a number six there. And I think he's got that blend of aggression but also playmaking ability that would make him a great addition to the Arsenal squad. Obviously, Tielemans, if he comes in, doesn't quite give Aston Villa as much protection. So I think it's a big blow for Villa. But just looking at Arsenal, on the flip side, we're talking about his counterpart, Jorginho, and not being able to play every single, you know, weekend to midweek to weekend. I think you've almost got to look at it in blocks now, you know, 2-3 games ahead. And to me, I've been walking back from the Bayern game. Who do you want to start there? And I think you saw it last night. I think I'd probably be tempted to put Havertz back into midfield in Munich with Jesus up front. So against Villa, I think with offside trap, you want pace in behind. Because at Villa Park, Arsenal got in behind quite a few times with Martinelli. So this is actually one of those games where I think Martin Elliott suits him because he can make those runs in behind and his pace will be key. Whereas Trossard maybe suits more in Munich. But yeah, to me, it's a game where you're thinking Havertz and Martinelli's movement, runs in behind, that's going to be the key to stretching the game. So yeah, it's not an easy one for Arteta to try and juggle because, you know, it's horses for courses. But I think you've got to look at the game types and the specific profiles.
David, Unai Emery knows the Emirates very well, obviously. It's his first time coming back as an Aston Villa manager. It'll be interesting to see. Jordan mentioned the high line that Villa play. Do you think they'll come to the Emirates with that sort of aggressive approach, or do you think maybe we'll see something a little bit more conservative from Emery like we have in games gone by?
Yeah, I think they're going to be incredibly conservative. I'd be flabbergasted if they tried to take the game to Arsenal and play the high line. I think they have pacing attack and they can sit back and they can properly counter Arsenal. And they would have watched the Bayern Munich game and seen that when Arsenal are slightly off it in their line and their high press and the whole team moving up, there is space in behind. And if anything, I think Emery will be wanting someone like Jakub Kurior to start for Arsenal just because of the lack of pace that he's shown to have on the back pedal. And I think left back is a really... It's interesting because we've said for a few weeks now that it's probably the area of their biggest strength in terms of depth with Jurrien Timber due to come back. And yet, Kurior has played really well, but had a really bad game against Bayern, and that's kind of thrown a few doubts in. And Zinchenko, I know Sam was saying that he was very influential in terms of his passing, but there were still a few occasions when Sané got at him, and had he kind of decided to take him on the outside, I think he could have had him. So I think left back is a really, really key position that Arteta needs to get right over the next couple of weeks. Otherwise, I fear they could start to have similar problems. But then again, Saliba and Gabriel won't have a worse game than they did have against Bayern.
He's Leroy Sané, Jordan. He goes past everyone. What are you going to do?
Well, I get it, but just Zinchenko 1-1. It's really bad to say he's not a good defender. He's a professional footballer, and he's obviously a decent defender. But just backpedaling 1-1, I get very nervy watching him. At least for someone like Tomiyasu, he's got a bit more pace and he can be a bit more physical. Whereas Zinchenko just backs off and backs off and backs off and. A few times, Sané, had he been a bit bolder, could have got in behind.
The way I saw it last night was that Kivior could neither invert, build up, or stop Sané. So you might as well bring on Zinchenko, who can't stop Sané either, but at least he can actually play football with it in midfield.
Yeah, I think Zinchenko really did himself a big favour last night because I was going into that game thinking I can't really see many games from now to the end of the season where you think Arteta's going to trust him defensively. You know, especially these away games at Spurs, Man U, you've got Villa as well, you know, Bayern. You're thinking these are the games where he's tended to maybe bring in Tomiyasu and for these individual games, but maybe he's played his way back into it for the reasons, you know, that we're spoken about.
Agreed. I thought he was a real grown-up on the pitch when Arsenal looked quite young and naive on the night. But having said that, he was also arguably at fault for the game where Aston Villa scored a winning goal against Arsenal. He was arguably at fault for that goal. So It's a real risk and reward with Zinchenko. But speaking of risk and reward, let's move on to the game that we've all been waiting for, the game that Jordan Davis has been, he's got his head in his hands already waiting for this one. But it is, of course, Gesper Gouna. Now, for those of you who don't know the rules to this game, it is very simple. I will read out a set of clues, relating to an Arsenal player. It will be up to Sam, Jordan and Jordan to buzz in and say who they think the player is. The first person to get it, of course, is the winner. So let's play Guess the Gouna. Okay, let's go. Clue number one. I was nominated for the 2014 Golden Boy Award. I was on the pitch. Sorry, Jordan.
Serge Gnabry.
Who?
Serge Gnabry.
Oh, no. Sorry. Glaswegian accent getting in the way there. No, not Serge Gnabry.
Too late.
I was on the pitch as Pep Guardiola claimed his first trophy in English football. I have been relegated from the Premier League twice.
Miachi?
No. I played in the first game that Arsenal had fans back at the Emirates after COVID. I have played for 5 Premier League clubs. I have 3. Sorry, Sam.
Hang on. Played for Arsenal in the first game back post-COVID.
First game where fans were back after COVID.
So that was Brighton at home?
No.
Thank you, Sam.
Brighton home had 10,000 fans.
That wasn't the first game where fans were allowed back in. I feel like I'm giving you too much now, so I'm going
to
stop.
I know which game you're talking about now, but I'm still baffled as to who this might be.
I have 3 caps for England.
Are you Ainsley Maitland-Niles?
No.
Callum Chambers?
Correct, Jordan Davis. Well done.
I've won one.
Calfu.
He was nominated for Golden Boy.
He was nominated for the 2014 Golden Boy Award. It's an amazing stat. Well done to whoever put him up for that award.
That's really off the scent, that Golden Boy.
Very happy with that. He was, of course, on the pitch when Manchester City beat Arsenal in the Carabao Cup final in 2017. He's been relegated from the Premier League with Middlesbrough and Fulham. He played against Rapid Vienna in the first game back. Was it Rapid Vienna or maybe Austria Vienna or one of the Vienna teams with the first game back for fans allowed? It was during COVID, maybe after COVID. It was a little bit of a misdirect there, so apologies for that. The 5 Premier League teams he's played for, can anyone name them?
Arsenal, Southampton, Fulham, Middlesbrough, Villa.
Very good, very Ooh. Good. He has 3 caps for England. In both of his loan spells, he was named player of the season for his team, obviously Middlesbrough and Fulham. He has scored 7 goals in 178 appearances. These are the clues that I was giving, that would have been given after Jordan got it. And can anyone guess how old he is? Because this really threw me.
I think he's 29 now.
28?
Yeah, he's only 29. He's only 29. Amazingly. I just assumed he'd be a lot older, given how long he's been around. But yeah, Jordan Davis, well done. You have won your first guest of the year. I've noticed a real weight off your shoulders there. You seem to really...
Pure relief coming from that side of the screen.
I'm like a new man. I've been battered for my opinions for almost an hour. It doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't matter.
Right, there is one chance for Jordan Campbell and Sam Dean to redeem themselves and see how much they've been paying attention. But how many Kylie Minogue pans have there been, guys? And listeners, maybe shout at the radio or the phone or whatever it is you've been listening to. But
it was getting snowy.
Do you have to say all the songs you mentioned or just a number?
You can, I mean, if you want to name all the songs I've mentioned, then they're fantastic.
I can't remember, but I think I've got a number.
That was really obvious and made me really laugh just as you were coming to me. And I can't answer it, but then things got so heated that I completely forgot what it was.
Yeah.
So I don't think you would have managed double figures.
I didn't manage double figures. That is correct.
I'm going to go for 6.
Six. Okay. Davis?
I thought it was four.
Dean?
Well, I definitely heard two, but I have to admit that when we were talking at the start about how big a Kylie fan we all are, I'm kind of not really a big Kylie fan. So there's probably quite a few that went really over my head.
I'm going to tell you a little secret. I'm also not as big a Kylie fan as I've presented myself. There's been a lot of Wikipedia going on to make puns here. The answer is seven.
Ooh.
So was it Jordan Campbell who guessed six? So I think you win by default there. I should be so lucky. Hand on your heart was in there. When I asked hand on your heart, do you think it should be a penalty? I referenced the tension in the section between us, the debate that was going to be coming. I did say when Harry Kane looked around, Gabriel was in his eyes, in your eyes. It's a bit of a stretch, but it's there.
Oh, wow.
When Arteta got in at halftime, he said, I believe in you. There you go. There's another one. Everything went from wrong to right. Of course, the lyrics from Love at First Sight. Spinning around, I think, is the pun that Jordan was referencing, where it was very obvious at the start. That was intended to throw you all off the scent. But I think, to be honest, I don't know if I should be proud of myself having fooled you there. I don't really know what I get for that. But I suppose I proved myself the number one Kylie Minogue fan. And with that, I can say Love at First Sight is undoubtedly the best Kylie Minogue song. And we will end it there. Of course, if you do want to hear more from us on the Arsenal Beat, we've got plenty of other episodes you can listen back to. Do leave us a review on, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, that really helps. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Just type in the Arsenal Beat and we will come up. Until our next episode, which we bring you next week after Arsenal Aston Villa before Bayern Munich. We're not sure where we're going to do that. Maybe we'll do it live from Munich. Who knows? We'll work it out. But until then, guys, thank you very much for listening and stay safe.